Hi, and welcome to DebtWired. I'm Andy Serby, Deputy Courts Editor at DebtWire. Now, let's get on to today's episode. Today, I'm glad to be joined by Sunny Singh and Gary Holzer, both partners at Weil. Welcome to the show, and since there's two of you joining us today, I'll let you guys do a quick self-intro before we get into the content.
Good morning. This is Sunny Singh. Good to be here, Andy. I'm one of the co-chairs of the restructuring group at Weil. I have been practicing for a little over 20 years, representing companies primarily and other stakeholders as well. You know, all sorts of in and out of court restructuring transactions.
Hi, this is Gary Holzer. Been at the firm 33 years, partner in the New York office, sit on the management committee, and have done a number of cross-border deals and company-side deals, and that's how I spend most of my time, like Sunny, in and out of court.
And today we're discussing the topic of what the alternative paths are that companies might consider taking when we consider it as an alternative to Chapter 11. Why might Chapter 11 potentially not be the best restructuring path for some companies?
Gary, you want to take this one?
Sure, I can start. There are instances where some of our clients on the company side find themselves in circumstances where they need to restructure, for example, one specific part of their capital structure. And there are implementation paths out there that allow for that surgical kind of restructuring without exposing the company to all of the other aspects of Chapter 11 that they might prefer to avoid, including for public companies, what happens when you file Chapter 11, which is an automatic delisting of the company on one of the stock exchanges where they might trade. And there are ways to avoid that while still accomplishing restructuring the debt, including a restructure where some holders of debt don't participate, but are nevertheless bound by proceeding which accomplishes that objective.
Yeah, one of the transactions that I think is quite interesting where Gary and I worked on together most recently to do exactly that is Fossil. Fossil, for those who may be less familiar with it, is a NASDAQ-listed company that's headquartered in Texas. And it had a very specific issue within its capital structure that it needed to address, but did not otherwise want to or need a full-blown Chapter 11 filing. And that specific issue was it had $150 million of retail bonds that was maturing in 2026 and therefore going current a year earlier. And they would have had a going concern qualification in their financials in November 2025 that would have been very problematic. And when Gary and I were working with the company, became quickly clear that they did not want to file for Chapter 11, didn't think they needed it, and it would have more sort of operational disruption and more harm than good. And to address that, we came up with and proposed a exchange transaction out of court with a UK restructuring that was backstopping the transaction. We can get into what that means and a little more specifics in a minute. But this transaction allowed the company to just surgically address its retail bondholders and bind 100% of the retail bondholders without having to cancel its equity. And Gary, maybe you want to expand upon that a little bit about what we did, but that was the end result, which is a very favorable outcome for the company.
Yeah, I think when you think about the Fossil transaction, many people like to start with the numbers. When we were engaged in March of 2025, the market cap of the company was $80 million. When the transaction closed through an English restructuring plan, which had been stapled to the SEC registered exchange, the market cap of the company was over $200 million. And the publicly listed equity remained in place throughout. The results of the restructuring were that the debt was extended by 2 years to 29, and the rate on part of that debt was increased from 7 to 9.5, and on another piece of it from 7 to 7.5 for those holders that did not choose to put in new money. And their maturity date was also extended. So when you start with what the result was, that was the answer the company wanted. The equity stayed in place and the maturity date of the bond instruments was extended to avoid what Sunny mentioned, which is the going concern qualification. Method for doing it was to attach the English restructuring plan to the registered exchange. And by doing that, the company was able to accomplish two things. One, created a guarantor entity in the UK. And again, this is a Dallas-based US company with New York law governed debt. That debt allowed the company to add the guarantor. And by doing that, we created jurisdiction in the UK. It happens that those bonds were held by very widely held. They're called baby bonds. So there were an enormous number of holders that we could not herd into one room and negotiate with. However, one holder had aggregated 51%, and that holder agreed to not only backstop new money, which you would typically see in the U.S. process and in an English process, but also agreed to vote as a part of the arrangement to change the governing law of the document from U.S. law to English law, which is not required for jurisdiction, but is helpful. When we did that and we went through the exchange process, we did almost get to the 90%, which was the threshold. We got to 83%, but the company and its main holder determined that it would be better to capture the last 17% and bind the what we call the stub. And when we did that, the restructuring plan in the UK only has a requirement for a vote threshold of those holders who vote in value, not numerosity, which is the case in Chapter 11 and under an English scheme. And so by using the restructuring plan, we avoided numerosity and we were able to confirm the plan, which was subsequently recognized in Chapter 15. And this is the first time a U.S. publicly listed company has stapled a U.K. restructuring plan to an SEC registered exchange. So that is when you think about liability management, which is all the rage today, and you think about what the current iterations of it are, this is a new frontier.
And to a certain extent, when we discuss alternative paths to Chapter 11 or to a formal restructuring in really any jurisdiction, it's about a certain degree of creativity. And I don't want to say fads seems like the wrong word, but there are cycles to what the in vogue thing to do is. It's been LMs, and then we have classic examples like lend and extend. So when it comes to coming up with alternative ideas to Chapter 11 from the perspective of you guys' practices, to what degree is it an exercise of being on the cutting edge or coming up with just new ways to do things? Because I've only ever heard the idea of going to a UK restructuring for something like this in one other context, and I've had it thrown around as like a theoretical way to avoid the home-based prohibition on non-consensual third-party releases or something like that. So how does this fit into that kind of mandate to get creative when you're trying to not go through bankruptcy?
You want to take that one?
Yeah. Look, I think many variations of out-of-court restructuring and the types of things we did in Fossil, it's an iterative process that's occurred over time. A lot of that stuff actually, Gary likes to say, was, and I agree, was invented in the labs here a while. Right, we did the J. Crew transaction early on, which was a drop down. We did Serta, now we've done Fossil. And all of these really, if you think about it, are case specific approaches for companies, depending on the facts and circumstances and what their objectives are, to have another tool in the toolkit. Right here, as we mentioned in Fossil, they, frankly, it would have been worse for them to go through Chapter 11 because of the numerosity issue, because they just had too many retail bondholders and the risk that some of them gather and vote against would have been very problematic. And so the UK restructuring made a lot more sense. For other companies, an out-of-court restructuring, whether it's through an LME transaction or just a creditor negotiation because you've got more private credit lenders and you don't need to go in court, makes more sense. And in other cases, it makes absolute sense to go into court and address the root of the company's problems. And in my mind, these tools, although of course refined and improved over time, you bring all these different tools that you have in the toolkit to the specific situation to see what you can achieve. And we're always innovating, we're always creating, we're always thinking about how can we either tack on or come up with something new. You know, interestingly, in Fossil, between while US and while UK, we had done each of the steps of the transactions independently in other deals. But this was the first time it all came together the way it did, and especially for a US publicly listed company going there. So I think you always have to be thinking about these issues as a restructuring lawyer in order to offer companies the best options and credit everybody the best options available.
And I guess the follow-up question is, because like you said, every situation is unique. No two clients or potential clients are going through exactly the same position. So when you're evaluating the path of restructuring in a way creatively out of court, or just going with one of the more classic examples, how do you evaluate whether it's really a true solution, whether you're really going to fix things out of court, or how do you tell a company that, I know you don't want to go through Chapter 11, but if we do this deal out of court, it's you're just going to file Chapter 11 12 to 16 months later?
I think it's a matter of degree. The way to think about it is companies and the stewards of capital that are involved in companies want to understand all their options. And when you reference an idea like, hey, will a particular option or one of the solutions we might propose actually, quote unquote, fix the company? It's a matter of what are you trying to accomplish? What are your objectives? So for example, in many of these situations, what the company is really looking to do is to create liquidity and runway to allow a business plan to turn favorably for the company and create an environment where it can work itself out of perhaps the situation it's in. Other times, a board may look at that option and assess whether or not creating that runway and making the concessions that might be made will statistically not be likely to get the company to the promised land. And the fix, as you put it, that's needed is more severe. And this is the most essential part of what a board has to decide, whether or not it needs to do something more severe or something with a lighter touch right now, and whether or not by choosing one of the options, you make it more difficult later to have optionality. And that's really what we confront with boards. And so they want to see the solutions. They want to understand what the advisor's recommendations are. And it will come down to a decision about, in the circumstances, how severe do they have to go? And it wouldn't surprise you to know that folks will frequently look at less severe options if they believe that can get them home on their business plans and allow them to get to a better place in terms of whatever is troubling them in their structure, whether it's liquidity, covenant issues, a going concern qualification, which may be a commercial issue as well as a default issue, or capital raising, or whatever else it is that's in the mix. But that's how we think about it.
And of course, no situation is perfect. No solution is perfect. I'm curious what kind of the hidden risks are for when you do execute a deal of any kind outside of court. What kind of things can typically or maybe commonly go wrong where you just end up in Chapter 11 anyway, and the deal was good, it's just things didn't break the right way?
I think when you're evaluating and when we're talking to boards about out of court, there's a couple of things that you always want to highlight for them as risks of an out of court transaction. And there are risks, and there may be mitigants, and there may be risks that are acceptable to the company and to the stakeholders. The most obvious one is probably the holdout problem. Out of court versus in court, you just can't bind people through a class vote like you could in court to maturity extensions or modifications to seek rights within the debt instrument. So we did in Fossil, right? We ended up doing an out-of-court exchange. We got 82% of people to say yes. The others basically just didn't respond because it was retail holders. And so the question was, hey, do you want to live with 18% of the debt as stub, or do you want to go in and close and get the rest of them to be dragged along? And so that's just an individual question for the company. And as Gary said, it's a matter of degree. I think if you're closer to 95, I bet you Fossil closes out of court. But the number was right there, and there was a number of other considerations in play there that we were able to and comfortable going through the in-court process. But whether you call it a risk or just a factor that needs to be considered when you're doing it out of court, it's what is the level of stub that you would be willing to live with as the company and stakeholders. And so you always have to be thinking about that. I think some of the other things too, particularly with liability management transactions, right? There's not a court-blessed transaction. And what I mean by that is things like fraudulent transfers or risks post-transaction relating to litigation and did you violate something. When you're going in court, you get that all approved and off the table up front. It offers you a level of certainty and no sort of tail litigation. Whereas if you're out of court, you almost have to assume, particularly just given how a lot of the transactions in the out-of-court world liability management have played out, that there will be some litigation, some stakeholders who are holdouts or not at the table or whatever the situation may be, they have the ability to bring litigation. And so you need to factor that into, you're going to stay out of court. Are you able to handle the press from that? Are you able to handle litigation costs and impact associated with that? So those are the types of things that I think out of court people need to really consider. And then the last thing I would say is probably out of court, in my mind, is great and effective when you are achieving a balance sheet fix. But then if you need a restructuring fix of the operations in the business, you actually use the time to do that. I certainly haven't gone back and studied every single case where there was an out-of-court liability management transaction and then followed by a filing, but those are frequent. That happens. One of the issues that they run into is they needed restructuring in the sense of operational restructuring in addition to a balance sheet fix. And either there wasn't enough time or the company couldn't take advantage of it or didn't take advantage of it, but the operational risk, i.e. the root of the problem, really wasn't addressed. And then people end up in a situation where they've done an LME, probably more restricted now in how they can actually implement either a future transaction or a Chapter 11 filing. And, you know, that those are the stuff you read about in the headlines.
Yeah, there is one other comment I'd like to make in response to your question, which is this. When you talk about the risks associated with an out-of-court deal, it's always a risk assessment that's relative to what happens in court. And of course, there's no certainty that a court will approve the transaction, even if you're delivering it with a high voter consent level. And the reason I mention this is because what is important to understand about Fossil and any other structured transaction where the venue that is selected is a venue that is being used to accomplish the transaction, whereas you might not be able to accomplish it in the same way in the venue that is governing the transaction before adjustments are made to accomplish it in the way we did in Fossil. And the reason I say this is because what people have to just get right with is Fossil was a situation involving forum shopping. And when we filed the case, there was no question that we were forum shopping to get to a venue, in that case, England, which would give us a more favorable outcome than we could accomplish in Chapter 11. And if you read a very reasoned decision by the judge in Fossil in England, in London, the judge goes through what good forum shopping is and what bad forum shopping is. And he concluded that in the Fossil situation, it was good forum shopping because what you were accomplishing was good for all the constituents and you couldn't accomplish it through Chapter 11 in that instance. And I mention that because there is risk that a court might not approve your transaction, even if you have proper jurisdiction. The court still has to go through the process in England or whatever other jurisdiction you're in. And what is laying in the weeds with that is you'll also want to get right recognition, as we did via Chapter 15 in the US. And in order to do that, you need to be comfortable that the process you've run in the foreign jurisdiction is going to be recognized in Chapter 15, particularly when you're dealing with notes that are governed by and administered through DTC and trustees, which require that you get Chapter 15 recognition. So I say that because it really is the other side of the coin, Andy, when it comes to what are the risks associated with out of court. You just have to measure those against the risks associated with in court. And that's what boards do all the time.
And it's interesting that you point out that opinion from England about what's good for the constituents is just good forum shopping, because a repeated phrase that I hear when we talk about restructuring and also Chapter 11 is the consensus is king. And ultimately, at the end of the day, what's good for everyone is good for everyone. And that's the goal of any real transaction. So thank you to both of you for taking the time and expertise to share with us today. And we'll hope to see you again sometime.
Appreciate it, Andy. Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks very much, Andy.
And thank you, as always, to our listeners for checking out this episode of Debt Wired. As always, you can find further insights in the form of articles and more data on our website, and you can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify or Apple. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.